when people sneeze, it's good to tell them, may the force be with you. That kind of can lead to a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast for December 22nd, 2010. We cannot listen to the lyrics to this song. That's why I potted the volume way, way down, and I'm talking very rapidly and at a high volume level, because I don't want you to hear the F word and the N word and all of the other terrible things that this song says, and I don't want to get kicked off the Liberty Radio Network. Okay, then, Brett, why are you using it as bumper music? Good question. The mood kind of struck me. This is actually the song that brought the phrase bling bling into popular culture all the way back in 1999. That phrase was coined by a young Lil Wayne, probably after he had drank a bunch of cough syrup out of a cup that looked like something that King Friday from the land of make-believe would drink out of on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Probably. And the rest is history. It's also one of those songs that I think I mentioned in an earlier show, I think called Holes, that brings me back to the early days of my educational career when I used to walk the hallways and the dorms of the residential school I used to work at. Those kids loved this stuff. This group was called the Cash Money Millionaires, and their videos were just, oh, so exciting. They would be out on yachts, and they would pull up in SUVs where they had put these giant, like, 20 or 30-inch spinner rims on them, and they would wave their jewelry around, and they had these gold and platinum teeth, and they would pour champagne all over some girl in a bathing suit that they had hired that day for the video shoot. And I used to like these videos because it was like looking into a crystal ball if you wanted to know who was going to be on E! True Hollywood Stories like 18 months later. But that's not what today's show is about. Another reason why I chose this song is because it seemed appropriate for some of the material that we're going to cover. It's almost kind of like somebody took the diary or the day planner of one of the people responsible for economic planning in this country now and as many decades as you want to go back in the past and turned it into a freaking hip-hop video. Really. It reminds me a lot of what we're dealing with today with respect to economics. Keynesianism, corporatism, spend, spend, spend. Just excess and recklessness to the max. Thoughtless greed, dangerous greed, destructive greed. And that is the topic of today's show, kind of. I include it because I have a larger goal. First, let me give you the backstory. This is an episode. It's actually just a sample of an episode, about a 45-minute clip of a show that runs about 2 hours. This is the Peace Revolution Podcast, number 12, The Origins of Money Roundtable. It is Richard Grove with his show, Jan Irvin of Gnostic Media, and Paul Verge from Divergent Films. That is the exact same crew from the What You've Been Missing installment of School Sucks Podcast from not too long ago. Now, as much as I admire these guys and their work, I realize the more we talk, the more there were some issues and topics that we didn't see perfectly eye to eye on. One of them was economics. Now, I think we all want to end up in the same place eventually. It was just a matter of ironing out a few details, and I think this show was an interesting exercise. Several months back, after Richard and I first started talking, he introduced me to a book called The Lost Science of Money by an author named Stephen Zarlinga. Zarlinga is the founder of a research group and think tank called the American Monetary Institute, studying economic policy, history, reform, and theory. And some of Zarlinga's conclusions were interesting. Richard felt that the book was worth taking a look at. I never read it, but I did listen to 4 or 5 hours Jan Irvin's interviews with Zarlinga on Gnostic Media, and I had some real problems with some of his conclusions and also his anti-Austrian theory position. So I thought we could all get together on Peace Revolution Podcast and have a bit of a roundtable on this topic. This is not a debate. There are no winners and losers. This is four friends getting together, admitting that in the past we've all fallen victim to a tremendous amount of confusion and propaganda and, you know, inundation of bad information. And we're trying to learn our way out by sharing information and, you know, looking at Zarlinga's rhetoric, looking at his evidence. And at one point, we even bring him into the conversation. So he doesn't stick around too long, but that I don't think was because of anything that I did. I think he was involved in some other things. So anyway, like I said, this is just a 45-minute clip of a much longer show. It starts about 42 minutes in, and then there's another 35 minutes after that. So go to Peace Revolution Podcast if you want to hear the whole thing. Thank you for listening, and take care.
So you have to ask yourself, with 15,000 hours of public school education, why are we not taught about the history of money, and why are we not taught a systematic form of critical thinking?
When both are so meaningful in our lives.
Daily lives.
Yeah, exactly. Can you, Rich, can you just repeat what you had said about law maybe 2 minutes ago? You used a phrase like words on paper.
The use of words came about, and then they started writing words down. And through the writing of words on paper, they created things called contracts. And back in pre-Grecian times, you could have someone called a logographer, and they are someone who would use words to defend you or to manipulate somebody else. These logographers basically became what we know as lawyers. And this comes from Corax of Sicily and the Sicilians, who taught the Greeks about rhetoric and persuasive ways of speaking and manipulating people, etc. This would come up through a Greek named Demosthenes, who was an orator, who died in 322 BC. We mentioned him in the last podcast because it's his specific style of selling out to both sides that the Skull and Bones have leveraged. So Demosthenes would be hired to write a speech for one side. He would then write that speech and sell it to the other side, and then write a speech for them and sell it back to the original side. So the idea of being able to profit off of both strokes of the engine, the upstroke and the downstroke. And that's the same pattern that we see in our economy. If you look at the graph of our economy, you know, I say our, but the American economy over the past 200 years, it has the same profile as that of an engine going up and down, generating power for a specific group that controls that engine. And as long as we are all unwitting cogs in that engine and not someone who can understand it from the outside, I mean, we continue to play into their game every day with all of our actions. So that's why we think, even though none of us claims to have a concise understanding, that we all recognize our incompetence in using money our whole lives, not understanding it, and seeking out at least the most provocative information that reflects reality, because what we've been given is obviously inaccurate.
I completely agree, and I just want to combine that with what Paul said a couple minutes ago about, Paul, you kind of defined wealth or money as a medium of exchange, that there are things that throughout history have civilization has determined has value, right? And it goes beyond gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And if you look at the commodities market in the Wall Street Journal, there's a long list of things that were completely essential to life for most of the last 1,000 years. You know, grains and pork bellies and all of these other things that are called commodities. So money. Let me not use that word here for a minute. We're talking, one of the things that I think is important to focus on as far as wealth is concerned is media of exchange. And I think that's what you were trying to say. Am I correct?
Yeah, just talking about the different forms of things that are recognized as having value, right? There's been cultures that thought shells had value for whatever reason, right? Other people think that precious stones, jewels, diamonds, rubies are, because of their supposed rarity, have this additional value, right? The perception of scarcity creates value. A lot of people think that in the future, water will be a form of currency. And you see the UN or environmentalists trying to push the idea of carbon credits, right? Your global carbon footprint, whatever that's supposed to mean, is a form of currency. You can't travel or have children unless you have enough carbon credits. So ultimately, it's a medium of exchange on the good side, but on the downside, it's a medium of control and enforcement of power.
And as far as the law is concerned, just back to Zarlinga, I had some real objections. It sounded like a reliance on law, which law is just words that powerful people write down on paper. And ever since people started actually writing the laws down, they said, well, geez, if we're keeping track, we might as well just keep going. And that's why we have, I don't know, what is it, 60 million laws on the books?
What he shows, though, when you get into his book, is that when you free up and properly place the money system out of the control of the private bankers and the usury, that these bureaucratic systems that have been established now naturally begin to fall away, because they're designed to protect those in power in their current cushy positions.
I totally agree with that.
When you remove that edifice, then you just have this law of the people, for and by the people, a government for and by the people itself, by law, agreeing to monitor and take control of the money system. So
now I say that's a completely implausible concept. Government does, that was why I said that the history of money has to parallel the history of states. Governments do not exist for the welfare or the well-being or the protection of people.
No, they're a front for the money people. They always have been. And that's right. that's where it comes from.
And this is what we're talking about, though. As Zarlanga shows in his book, it's never been tried the other way, where the money has been put into full control of the people. It's always been the elitists using the government as a force to protect their money and their systems of controlling the society. So this, in effect, would flip it in its antithesis, which, as I mentioned earlier, and he admits, you know, it's never been done before.
Well, this is why we advocate this theoretical freedom. So right now we're reaching an even point where he admits that he's talking about something that at this point in history is theoretical, and I admit,
well,
as somebody,
well, he's showing that via history, all of these other things have already been done. Here's basically what's left that hasn't been done. And here are the exact steps on how it should be done.
All right. Well,
but on the other hand, there's another way that it can be done that it hasn't been done. And if we're going to be theoretical, here's what I've learned, that the people who know how to use words and create laws and therefore create money out of nothing to control us have taught us something. And let's just sit back and appreciate this fact. If they can do it as states, why can't we all print our own money as individuals? And maybe that's the future of currency, because if you were able to print your own money debt-free and you didn't owe usury to anybody else, then everyone could print as much money as they needed to, and then everyone would just be free of money because it would be ubiquitous, like water to fish.
Why would it have value?
It doesn't have value now. It's debt. That's the whole thing. It's like, once you understand it, if it's going to be a game, why not be a game, an imaginary game with a magical checkbook in our favor? Why can't one of us have the banker's checkbook and I'll just write a check for $13 quadrillion and pay off the national debt, and now, you know, we can focus on something else? Why do they have that power and we let them for centuries just wield that power, and we take away their power but leave them the right, you know, a check, and they buy all their power right back? Zarlinga's opening quote is a Tolstoy quote about power. I'll just read it to you real quick because it's a short quote. It says, "History can only be explained by introducing a power which they apparently do not recognize." That's from War and Peace. It's kind of like Tragedy and Hope. So, do you get what I'm saying? It's like, without recognizing this one piece that has always been controlling power and money and creating these governments as proxies, it's like they went from feudalism to what we know as democratic republican government because of the fact that someone invented a guillotine, and the royalty said, hey, we need a proxy between us and them. And hey, better yet, let's make the slaves think they're already free so no one really fights for their freedom. And better yet, let's just have them sign away their bodies at birth as these straw man corporations. And better yet, let's have them sign contracts, and, you know, making them indentured to this whole system, which they don't have a chance at understanding until we all got together to try to flesh this out.
And those, I totally agree with what you're saying right there. And just back to what I was saying before we go forward here, that we're all kind of at this point going forward where we're into the realm of theory. But if Zarlinga's ideas are turning something over to the people through a government where the people theoretically have power over the government because they can vote, we would say that a free market, some kind of commodity-backed medium of exchange, would be superior to that, because people, in a totally free market, people could vote every day with their feet and with their wealth. They wouldn't be just sort of...
Let's just focus on the point why we have to speak in hypothetical terms right now. Because the cartel that exists that controls everything, no one's figured out how to get them out of power. And what we thought was, the only way they're in power is through them taking advantage, because critical thinking has been taken out of the education system, to educate people so they can be autonomous. And then once you're autonomous, you don't really have a need for government. It's like training wheels. You can take them off at that point. It's not a big deal. But asking people to take the training wheels off before they know how to ride the bike scares people. it scared us as kids, right? So just use that metaphor and think about it. And I think what we need to get to here is that I'm not here to defend Zarlingo's work in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that he's the only person I've ever found in a book to give you 23 case studies of what money has done and what it has been to different civilizations, how those civilizations came to fall, because it all had to do with money. As you follow the pattern through, it repeats. History repeats until we think for ourselves and start to learn from it. So these are the essence. That's the essence of what I'd like to represent from reading this book, because I found it useful. I found it, it is an expensive book and it is a tough read, but it's intrinsically interesting because he's going to Del Mar and bringing together all these different historians who before, if you're an economist, you do not get this education. And then you have to ask yourself, no wonder the ruse is so easy to perpetrate in our financial markets, because even the people on TV reading the teleprompters have no idea what they're talking about. And that's the brilliance of how they keep it secret.
And just for the record, too, there's a lot of things that I heard him say just in these interviews that is accurate, that I agree with him on. My concerns were, I can't question his grammar, obviously, coming from his position of research to my position of knowledge. That would be foolish on my part. I can't question too much of the logic, how he's integrating these different...
I think you can very well do that, because he lays out his sources in his book, and it's very easy to go in and check them out and follow them through and check their veracity. But
no, he's saying he agrees with the grammar and the logic, and I don't think any of us necessarily agree or support his rhetoric. We just all find the grammar and logic of it to be useful.
Okay.
All right,
yes.
And useful is the word that I would use, because I should correct myself that I did have some objections to his adamant definition of money in this Aristotelian way that he did. But my issues came up with the rhetoric, his presentation, and in his conversations with you, I understand that it's not a reading. It's not him reading 300 pages of the book. It's him presenting ideas to, for lack of a better word, to try to sell the book to people. And I don't mean actually like physically get somebody to give him $40 for it. I mean sell these ideas and spark up people's interest in what he's trying to say. Now, that's where I had a real problem with him. I felt like he employed a number of logical fallacies, and he did not do a spectacular job of responding to criticism. And what that makes me think, even though that it's speculative, is how much of this is motivated by an agenda, and what is it? Now, those are both speculative.
Well, that's a good thing, and I've talked to him a number of times on the phone, on and off the air, and I haven't ever felt much sense of an agenda with him, and it is something that I have paid attention to. What I do find that he becomes most frustrated with, and being a writer myself, I totally get it, is that people tend to attack your work before they've thoroughly studied it. His whole thing, and why he likes presenting on my show so much, and he's probably done more interviews on my show than anyone else, but the reason why he likes my show is because before I ever came to him to do this interview, I got the book, I read the book from cover to cover, and then I made out a list of questions based specifically on his research, and I came to him and I said, hey, these are the things I'd like to talk about. These are the questions I have. These are the concerns. And so then we went through and we talked about those points. And so he appreciates that approach the most. And I would say that the only caveat that I would have, and it is a logical fallacy on my part, poisoning the well, is that his loose affiliation because of the annual summit in Chicago at the University of Chicago, which is run by Rockefeller. That's my only concern, but I can't prove that there is any direct connection. It's just where they hold the convention.
He also went to the University of Chicago. That's where he was educated. So that's where some of his ideas might come from. So that was the only caveat that I could think of.
And I've also heard him rail on a lot of the Chicago school's ideas as well.
Well, and he'd be the first person I know that is, if he's establishment University of Chicago and trying to put out a bad idea, he's the first person I've ever seen in print who has referred to Eustace Mullins and to Carol Quigley and to all this other pieces of very credible history that's well documented with primary sources. That's the angle that I could imagine.
Well, and just to give an example, like I have a couple of examples of his rhetorical style that I found problematic. But I said we'd come back to this term, the invisible hand.
And we never claimed that he was a perfect rhetorician.
But right? I'm just saying, but these kinds of statements or these kinds of arguments raise questions for me about what exists before this point in the foundation. I mean, this is the end product. This is what he's presenting to other people. So an example would be
in the book
and in the interviews as well, which, I mean, he should be able, I believe that he should be able to deliver responses to important counterarguments, invalid counterarguments, in a way that is not dismissive. And just an example of what I'm talking about is the phrase invisible hand. Adam Smith's invisible hand comes up. He says, this is something that they can't explain. There's no good reason. And then he ad hominems it by calling it a cop-out. Now, we can all see the hand in today's economy. It's a black gloved fist that reaches into the pockets of taxpayers and takes out $700 billion and gives it to Goldman Sachs and AIG. We know what the hand looks like, right? We can see the hand, right? When we're talking about an invisible hand, we're talking about what I would call as either market signals or a feedback loop. Now, this is something that's very, very easy to define and there's been definitions available and explanations of the phrase invisible hand for over 100 years. What we're talking about is when I say people can vote, people can participate in decision making with their feet and their wealth, that's the signals. Like, the government has no market signals because they take money by force. In a truly voluntary free market system, people have 100% choice about where they go and how they spend. Now, that's a continuous feedback loop that is essentially the invisible hand of the free market.
Now, what I was going to say is that...
Theoretically.
Theoretically, exactly. But what I was going to say is that Zarlinga does dedicate a good portion of his book to investigating the history behind the idea of the hidden hand and the theories behind it, and in my opinion, does a sufficient job to refute those ideas.
In what way?
Showing that they're invalid, showing that the history of the claims behind the hidden hand and how it's supposed to work don't stack up to the history when you actually go in and look at it. It's purely based on theory. It's not based on looking in the history books at all and basing it on any fact.
It's true, because that's how Adam Smith has to cloak Machiavellian and von Clausewitzian tactics, which is where the Prussian education system came from. And the Prussian education system came from the same place that spawned the Illuminati and the Skull and Bones, and they all conspired to dumb us down.
Another thing that I feel like he's doing is we inherit, us four guys and everybody else living today is certainly our generation. I think we are all within the same generation realizing that we are inheriting complete insanity. Complete insanity.
I think we're disowning that complete insanity because we had nothing to do with it. That's status quo trying to put us on it, and we have to make the model obsolete.
Right. But our parents don't realize that. Our grandparents don't realize that. So this was the time where we realized, wow, for all of history, people have been, for lack of a better word, batshit insane.
They've really been asleep. They've been manipulated and they've been asleep. They've refused to turn around and look away from the shadows on the wall of the cave, of Plato's allegory of the cave.
Right. And the difference between, in my conception and my understanding at this point, of the Austrian school theoretical proposal for an economic system of the future and what Zarlinga's conclusions are, is that Zarlinga seems to be suggesting that we build a new economic system that caters to a pre-existing problem. If a state exists on this landmass or anywhere else in the world, this problem sooner or later happens again. Everything is consolidated right back into the same hands as long as the weapon can be held by those hands. Right or left, it doesn't matter. If the weapon is there, history will repeat itself. So that's why, and I understand that he might have done a phenomenal job in the book paralleling the history of money with the history of states. But as long as the state is, the Fed can be nationalized, as long, you know, as long as the United States government exists, the United States Federal Reserve System will be there. Because all of those people who are decision makers in the government benefit from the existence of the Fed. When the Fed prints money, it goes to the lobbying interest, it goes to the military industrial complex, it buys them votes, it gets them reelected. They love the Fed. Right, and that's another reason.
What you're advocating is a total collapse, where what he's trying to do is figure out a way that we can transition without creating a vacuum.
But I don't think he's right. I think it is yet to be described, and what Jan is describing is how far we've gotten thus far, and Brett's describing here's where we want to be, and it's our job to build a bridge between those two points, even if a bridge hasn't been constructed yet. We got to get the components.
And it's very much in the work that you guys are doing and I'm trying to do with this and what we're doing right now. And it's a slow, gradual process. You know, I felt like saying to that guy who worked for the government that I interviewed a month ago, you guys got to slow down. Like, this whole thing can't collapse before people are ready to accept and understand good ideas or ideas that lead to peace and real prosperity.
But they're conditioned right now to emotionally react to those ideas on purpose. I mean, the opposition has set traps. They've set booby traps. It's like a minefield. When you try to communicate with somebody, you have to stop and think, where is this person's emotional minefield? How's it laid out? Oh, if I step over here, they're going to go off about this. So you have to get to know people and try not to step on those mines, because they don't want to go off about what their religious belief is and all this other stuff. But if you step there, they will, and they'll go to an emotional reaction. And the goal is to maintain an adult level through conversations, because an adult is intellectual over emotional. In the way children think, it's emotional over intellectual. So we don't want to slip into this childlike way of thinking, but the way the education system has conditioned us, we are all adult adolescents until we recognize our incompetence and then learn for ourselves how to learn and then integrate a systematic form of critical thinking and creative problem solving.
I absolutely agree. And I stand by that statement that I feel like he is, in many ways, trying to cater to a pre-existing problem, what I would call wrestling for the gun.
Why don't we see if we can bring him into the conversation?
Okay.
All right, give me I'm going to make a couple of phone calls, so let me do that for a minute and see if I can get a hold of him.
Okay. I'll play the Jeopardy theme, and we'll cut this out of the final production, right, Brett?
Well, it's funny that basically we're both talking about theoretical things, neither of which can really be put in place unless we have a responsible citizenry that can actually hold the government accountable.
Or could receive the ideas to be able to hold the government accountable. But the reason here's how we got here, Brett. From my perspective, I've been trying to communicate certain truths to the public. And what I discovered was that even when I get my words right, they can't hear my words. It's noise to them, so I have to give them a translator so they can turn the signal that I'm sending into a signal that they're actually receiving. They don't have the codec for systemized critical thinking so that they can actually discern fact from fiction. And without that, they're left not knowing what to believe, right? Mm. But if they could use this system to identify, hey, what I have here is definitely fiction, so let me go find some fact, and then you have this little bell that goes off. It's like, this identifies fact. Here it is. No contradictions, all the grammar, logic, and rhetoric is not bending anything out of place. There's no fallacies being used to try to deceive you. It's just straightforward. Here it is, facts that are verifiable, connected in a verifiable way, and presented in an honest manner.
Well, it goes back to the principle of self-ownership, too, right? You, instead of having like an overseeing government, it's like you're supposed to be self-governing. The real government's supposed to be yourself. At some point, we were like, oh, I can't handle governing myself. I need someone else to govern me. And we deferred our power to someone else. And, of course, someone else is going to come along and be like, oh, really? You want to give me your power? Sure, I'll collect
your power. Hey, Brett, if I came to your door and I said, I'd like you to outsource your decision-making to this group of people at a corporation, which is psychopathic, because that's how those things work, right? Like, we would never do that, but that's what we've all ended up being conditioned to do since we were kids, was outsource our critical thinking to the quote-unquote experts, the people who hold corporate jobs and are paid to lie to us.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. And no, Rich, I wouldn't do that.
Well, that's good.
Okay, you guys, Steven is ready.
Hello, is that you, Jan?
Yes, that's me, Stephen. We're all here. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? I'm on the speakerphone.
Yes, we can hear you all right. I'm here with Richard Andrew Grove of Tragedy and Hope. I'm also here with Paul Verge of Divergent Films and Brett Vinat of the He Hosts the School Sucks podcast. And we've been here doing a roundtable discussion for about the last hour and a half on your work. And wanted to bring you in for a minute. Brett had a couple of quick questions that we felt would be best for you to address specifically, and then sort of take it from there.
Go ahead. As I mentioned, this is a very tough time because I'm so busy with something that's urgent. But go ahead. What are your questions, guys? And first, thanks for having your discussion.
Oh, you're welcome. Go ahead, Brett.
Hi, Stephen. This is Brett Vinat. And one of the things that I was interested in about your work was your conclusions. And, you know, I only, in my opinion, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, the only way that I see, you know, a stable economic system that really works towards the person, you know, the average person's interests, ever evolving, and we're not talking about tomorrow or, you know, in 5 years, I think that this is a very gradual process, is in the absence of any kind of state control at all. And I think that one of the things that seems to be absent from a lot of these conclusions is what I would describe as the psychology of power. I think that one of your conclusions was to nationalize the Federal Reserve Bank. And In the short version of my question, I guess, would be like, how does the same problems that we deal with today, how do you prevent them from reemerging if this central banking system still essentially exists?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing you're trying to do, you know, our Constitution has worked fairly well, not perfectly, but our system of checks and balances has provided good examples of how things should be. And what all we're doing is putting the monetary power under the system of checks and balances. It's not there now.
Well, as far as the system of checks and balances is concerned, I taught history for a number of years in private school. And in the end of you know, my study, or, you know, the conclusion that I came to is that the power granted to the U.S. federal government by the United States Constitution accounts for about 5% of the power and scope that it has today. So I would question the efficacy of the checks and balance system. I think in the last 10 years, especially during the administration of George Bush, we saw that if it even had been working before that, it was pretty much dead. So I don't know how it could be revived in the future. I mean, if we really look at the United States government, we could go all the way back to the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. I would say for sure we could go back, even if we wanted to start at FDR, that more and more and more and more power. Remember, my big concern is power and the existence of this legitimacy around, you know, government, which is essentially the socially acceptable use of force.
Well, I think you have to remember, Brett, that you're also taking the money power out of the banker and the financier's hands by putting it into the hands of the people. They're not going to have that economic power that they do now to control things. And a lot of those bureaucracies are going to fall away. Would you agree with that, Stephen?
I really can't give the attention that you would need at this point in time. As I mentioned right at the start, I'm really, really involved in something that I have to focus on. We could reschedule this for another time in about a week.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Why don't we do that then?
All right. Let's do that. Because I think you do want to put this on the air eventually. I'd love to answer your questions. But, guys, you're not asking me questions. You're telling me your positions. And I don't have time for that right now, much as it interests me. But I'm just on a very tight schedule at this point in time. If you had, you know, really short, specific questions, I could try to do that now. But I cannot get involved in a longer discussion.
All right. Well, let's follow up with you next week then.
All right. One more quick question.
Go ahead, Brett.
How do you see that power being prevented from reemerging? I guess is one. Or how do you see the current condition of government being rolled back to the point where the people actually did control it?
Brett, first of all, what you're admitting in your question is that it's a real problem right now. That
has, oh, yeah.
And we have to do what we can to take back the monetary power. Monetary is just one element, but it's, in my view, the main one. And if we can remove that one from this private gang, let's call it, that it doesn't give it much care about Americans or America, that's a big step forward. It may not be the whole thing that's necessary, but it's a step forward. And it's a kind of optimism that I have that we are not captives of history, that we can make meaningful changes ourselves going forward if we will act. And we'll have to become better citizens as part of the answer. We have to get away from television, get away from the kind of control, avoid the madness that's on the Internet, and focus on the good things that are there. It won't be easy, but it has to be done because the alternative is pretty bleak.
Well, very generally speaking, I agree with almost everything that you just said, especially using the word gang, and the only exception would be using the word citizen. But if you need to wrap up right now, I think the point you just made, there's a lot of things there that I agree with, and I would certainly look forward to talking another time when you have more.
I can give you one more question in a different area of what you're discussing. You're wondering how we do that. And we have to untangle about a generation of miseducation, about a generation of propaganda, you know, since radio and TV and now the Internet have reached such large percentages of the audience. The form of media has changed. We have to untangle a lot of the damage that's been done. But there are people who know how to do that, and Jan is one of them, and he's working on that. He's having an effect. It doesn't happen automatically. It doesn't happen easily, but it has to be done, and it's work.
Mm.
It's generally unpaid work, which makes it all the harder.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Very good.
Thank you, Steve, for taking your time.
Sorry, I don't have the time just at this minute.
That's all right, Steve. I called you just on a whim, so I really appreciate it.
Well, that's always worthwhile.
Well, we hadn't talked for a few months anyway, so I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
One of the things that I'm trying to put forward here is that the current Federal Reserve System is one of the most successful embodiments of what government is supposed to do. That's what it's for. The state was set up to concentrate resources into the hands of very few people by taking them from a large group of people. Go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years, that's what governments do. He mentioned the Constitution. The fact that a bunch of slave owners and aristocrats wrote, you know, stuff down on four sheets of paper 230 years ago did not change the course of history. And that's not me being cynical, that's empirical.
But let's keep in mind that the Greeks also owned slaves. So all these people who created the laws and the rhetoric and all the things that are used to formulate this control today come from historical slave owners and the minds of those people. So what we're realizing for the first time is that we weren't free as Americans. We've never been free in the history of mankind from this money system as long as history goes back in time. Mm-hmm. That's what we've learned. So we're coming to this realization and trying to figure our way out by learning the history of that which currently enslaves us, which what you said was true. It goes back to the Federal Reserve Act, most recently, because that's the latest version of the snake shedding its skin over time.
Yeah, in this country.
There's like this long chronology, right, where there's all these different merge points, right? Like this goes all the way back to the beginning.
All the way back, yeah, pre-biblical. This starts in the earliest forms of exploration because
Jesus going into the temples, knocking over the money changers' tables. You know,
the beginning of what you've been missing. That's what we're showing. This has gone on, and it's time to break the pattern by learning from the history that we haven't been spoon-fed. This is about going out and finding out for ourselves. And it's like if Zarlinga hadn't composed this compendium of these 23 different case studies, then we would all be faced with doing that ourselves. But at least we can nitpick it and pick his apart and improve upon it. It's a starting point, and it saves us a lot of work. Like I said, I have no tie to his overall solution, but if his solution is framed from these case histories and the case histories are accurate, it might be worth trying to figure out what the next best form or realistic form of that might be.
That maybe in history, one thing that we're taking for granted is we have never actually really had real representational government, right? It's always been called that, but it's only really been a form of corporate governance. And the idea of government and the state being two different things, the state being this entity that kind of results, which inevitably becomes a power vacuum or a gang or a gang, you know, bunch of gangsters, and actual government is just how things are taken care of, right? So if you have self-government, and if we ever had in history some real form of representational government, then perhaps you would have the oversight necessary to quote-unquote nationalize the monetary system and use a form of responsible fiat currency like Zarlinga is advocating. But until we have a citizenry that's educated enough across the board, you know what I mean, who could handle that responsibility of being vigilant enough to have proper representation, then yeah, we're just going to continually be at the mercy of this threat of the central banking cartels or these monopolies continually trying to take over. You know what I mean? Infiltrate and take over. And that's what we've never been free of. We've never been free of our own ignorance.
And there's some real logical problems with the concept or that phrase today, representational government, that based on this kind of premise that people are incapable of making all of these important decisions in these various aspects of their lives, but what they are capable and smart enough to do is pick one person to theoretically make all of those decisions. And I don't think that the concept of representational government is particularly valid, because could one person really represent two or three strangers, right? Yeah, if you look at the scope of government, now maybe if the system was truly representational, it would be nowhere near that scope. But is that even possible? Could that even be done?
Yeah, that's the thing. Could we ever have adequate representation? Because the danger of giving your power away to someone else is that they might be willing to take your power away.
Mm. Well, I think when people had critical thinking in the trivium, I think probably during the Greek Senate, everybody in a town would participate in the debates and in government, and therefore literally had a say so.
Town hall style, yeah. Like voting in a council, I guess, is a better idea than a representational government. Because if there's a council and it's open meetings and everyone can go there and essentially get their voice heard instead of this kind of bureaucracy town hall meeting thing that's very staged that we have now, you know, from what I saw, from what you've been missing, the section with Donald Kagan talking about, the ancient Greeks and how everyone almost, you respected the political process because everyone was trying to be responsible, and they wanted to keep the state's holdings and the state's bureaucracy very minimized. So it was your duty to become educated, to learn exactly how polis works, right? How all these political ideas could be formed between people to move the society supposedly forward. And you do, this quote-unquote culture does make this progress, but like you've pointed out, it's often guided by these monopolistic interests, right? So we need to learn that critical thinking so that we're looking out for our own rational self-interest instead of falling prey to corporate interest.
Well, I mean, the other thing too, you know, the very idea of the republic or democracy has since its existence, even though it only really became very powerful, the will of the people only became something popular when the will of God fell out of favor at the age of reason. When those, we can't say that it's God anymore. All right. Well, then it's you. How about that? It's all of you. Then democracy has been a way, I think, in many respects, of conditioning ordinary people to think like elites and the small group of the people who have been the masters, because they say their mentality is it's okay for us to control other people. It's okay for us to control other people.
Well, and they're the ones who were behind the religions in the first place. So they came up with these tactics. They created the major religions through conglomeration of the different traditions so that they can control wider and wider groups of people. Alexander the Great came up with the idea of conquering the world, and other people had thought, hey, that's a great idea, and it hasn't been done yet until recent century and when it got under control. And these ideas, again, it all percolates through learning how to learn on your own so that you can open yourself up to being able to ask questions and find your own answers through a systemized process that you can apply to anything. So you don't have to be intimidated by anything that you don't know anymore. You don't have to be fearful by the unknown. You can take it as an invitation to learn. Oh, there's something that comes up that hasn't been on your radar screen. Now take it onto your radar screen through this process. It's just like if you had a process for opening your mail, like having it come through the spam filter, like we talked about. It's about this methodology that you practice on everything that comes in so you can find greater consistency. And once you have that, your map is more accurate. And then it's useful when you give other people directions on how to get where they want to go.
Right. And what I was saying is that there's no innate ethics in a democratic system. Right? Like Cecil Rhodes got up in the morning and maybe looked at himself in the mirror and said, I deserve to control other people by force.
No, he had a slave tell him that, probably. Right?
But the ordinary people do the same thing. They say, I deserve to control other people by force if I'm in the larger group of people.
Well, that's just twisted to start with. It's twisted that any of us were conditioned to accept that as some sort of reality. And I think once you realize that's what goes on. Right. It's a lack of thinking.
It's a lack of critical thinking.
But it's a problem. It's a problem innate in that system too. I mean, that's like the idea.
Well, that's only the slaves can only be slaves by their lack of ability to be able to think. So
agreed.
That's why creating a critical thinking meme, a trivium meme, is so important.
Because we all practice citicisms all day, things that we parrot that we've been conditioned to know, but we've never really thought about. And critical thinking, the systematic form, forces you to question things. It's like, I might use something like knock on wood or something like that. And Jan would say, hey, wait, what does that mean? Are you using a cynicism? And I'd be like, oh, you got it. Yeah, totally, dude. Thank you.
Oh, that's cliche.
When people sneeze, it's good to tell them, may the force be with you. That kind of can lead to a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, it's those little things that change it up, and it's just like every time you recognize a cliche, if you can prevent yourself from proliferating that cliche or that cynicism, that thing that you heard, because we've all been taught to do it. It's like it used to be like in single life, you'd go out and you'd try to meet new people and you'd try to talk about interesting things. And I bet 99% of the people listening were just like the rest of us, and we would parrot things that we heard from other experts or people on TV or the Wall Street Journal or whatever. Never thinking about those things ourselves. And then people would, you know, who thought for themselves would argue with you. You know, and finally, you get the point that, wow, I'm incompetent. I have not been questioning all these things. And the person I just encountered clearly does. I have to have some respect for that person for making it clear because that fact has avoided me for the first 30 years of my life. And then you spend another 6 years trying to get over your incompetence and you figure out, I am consistently incompetent, and all I can ever do is kind of whittle that down and fill in these blind spots, because there will always be blind spots. But what's important is having a process to deal with all of this, because it gives you serenity of mind. It means you can take all that stuff off your plate, because now you just have an intake process where you can validate these things, and you're not going to be plagued by all these illusions of history that we've been programmed with, which is how the status quo remains. It keeps us broken through this process of ignorance and pseudo-knowledge. And once we can recognize that, we take all the power away from the people who are really behind everything we've been trying to describe through this whole discussion.
And I was just going to add, if people want to get an idea of how these different ideas are marketed to people to kind of change through social engineering, which sets us up to take advantage of our lack of critical thinking and push through all this monetary skullduggery, then they should check out, and you can find these documentaries free online. Adam Curtis, a filmmaker in Britain, has made a film called The Living Dead, The Century of the Self, The Power of Nightmares. All of these films look very in-depth into the origins of these different ideologies of how, you know, governments, national and international views, people's desires and you know, creating a class of consumers and guiding them in all their desires. So that what you essentially have to realize is that all these different systems of control are interrelated, but they're all based off of our ignorance. They're all ignorance-based profit models, whether it's religion or politics or money. So the first cure, the real solution first, is to get yourself educated and learn something like the trivium so you can teach yourself. All his films give a lot of good background to everything we've been talking about, kind of all the things going on in the background. And, yeah, they feed into each other in a big cycle, as Brett said, right? So if you find one point, the weakest point, and can break it, which is really our own ignorance, none of this stuff can go on if we're not providing our own energy as batteries for these systems, right?
They're that greedy. They figured out how to get us to comply to our own indenturement, and Paul is exactly right, and he's going to continue explaining this, but the point is, they get us to volunteer for our slavery and to love our servitude, and once you can question it, you won't love it so much. Bling, bling. Every time I come around your city, bling, bling. Think you rang word about pity, bling, bling. Every time I buy a new guy, bling, bling. The rest hold on, you know I'm a trash, bling, bling. Every time I come around your city, bling, bling. Think you rang word about pity, bling, bling. Every time I buy a new guy, bling, bling. The rest hold on, you know I'm a trash, bling, bling. Every time I come around your city, bling.